This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Anniversary of Igor Stravinsky's masterpiece, The Rite of Spring. Here in Portland, new choreography to Stravinsky's score will be performed by the Agnieszka Laska Dancers in collaboration with the PSU Orchestra under the direction of Ken Selden. The performance of The Rite of Spring will take place Friday, June 7th at 8 p.m. at Lincoln Hall on the Portland State University campus. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
In honor of June being Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Pride Month, Treasures from the KBOO Vault will be listening to two pieces of Queer Public Affairs aired on KBOO in the 1990s. The first piece we will hear was recorded October 11, 1991, for the Old Mole Variety Hour by Andy Simon. Many of those interviewed in Andy's piece mention the OCA. The OCA was the Oregon Citizens Alliance. In 1988, the OCA sponsored Measure 8, an initiative that repealed Governor Neil Goldschmidt's executive order banning discrimination based on sexual orientation in the executive branch of state government. The measure not only repealed the executive order, but also put a statute on the books that prohibited any job protection for gay people in state government. Citizens of Oregon responded to the OCA by becoming organized and active. In 1992, when the OCA proposed Measure 9, which was an attempt to amend the Oregon Constitution by adding a provision that the state, quote, recognizes homosexuality, pedophilia, sadism, and masochism as abnormal, wrong, unnatural, and perverse. The ballot measure was defeated 56% to 44%. That same year, the Oregon Court of Appeals declared Measure 8 unconstitutional. This piece was recorded in 1991, during the mobilization of the queer community. The first voice we will hear is KBOO volunteer Andy Simon.
On October 11, 1987, hundreds of thousands of gay, lesbian, and bisexual Americans and their friends and supporters converged on Washington, D.C. to demand an end to discrimination based on sexual orientation. Since then, October 11th has been celebrated as National Coming Out Day. Tonight, an enthusiastic crowd of 600 to 700 people have gathered at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland to celebrate the event. No doubt the size and energy of the gathering is in part a response to the attempts by the Oregon Citizens Alliance, a right-wing political group, to deprive gays and lesbians of their civil rights. The OCA is getting ready to circulate two petitions to put ballot measures to the vote. One, a statewide initiative, would amend the Oregon State Constitution to declare homosexuality a perversion. The other would overturn the City of Portland's recently enacted ban on discrimination against gays and lesbians. Tonight's celebration is an upbeat affair. There's music and speeches, as well as a variety of literature tables. A highlight of the program promises to be the open mic, which will give many people the opportunity to come out in public and tell a little bit of their stories. I'm going to try to talk with a few of tonight's participants. I'm talking with Kathy Loftus, who's one of the organizers of this event. I wonder if you could tell me just a little bit about what the intent of the event is.
Well, this year, No One Hate sponsored this event because the OCA is organizing an initiative. It's called the Abnormal Behaviors Initiative, and this is a kickoff to that campaign. It's going to last for a couple of years, and we thought that coming out was appropriate because we feel that it's an act of selfhood and of owning yourself, and that's pretty much why we're fighting the initiative.
No on Hate, then, is an organization that's put together for the specific purpose of fighting the OCA, the Oregon Citizens Alliance Initiative. Is that right?
That's correct. We're a grassroots organization. We just got started about a couple of months ago, and already it looks like our events are showing some promise, and we really hope to get the lesbian and gay community organized and fired up about fighting this initiative so the same thing doesn't happen that happened 2 years ago when Measure 8 passed. So this is basically an attempt to inform people about what's going on with the Oregon Citizens Alliance and why we have to keep fighting for our rights.
What would you say about the event? Is this a success? You like the way it's going?
I love it. I love it. I love this community, and they really come out, and it's more than any of us expected, I think. We just keep getting more and more people coming out this evening. It's great. It's exhilarating.
I'm talking with Donna Redwing of the Lesbian Community Project. Tell me, Donna, what does this Coming Out Day celebration mean to you, and why are you involved with it?
Well, actually, it is the national holiday for lesbian and gay people. It's also Eleanor Roosevelt's birthday, which is kind of nifty. For me, it's a chance to come out a little more, and it's a chance to watch other folks in their coming out process. There are a lot of people here who weren't here 2 years ago. The crowd is probably 10 times larger than it was 2 years ago. I think that people realize that the most important political step they can take right now is to come out as a lesbian or gay person. When people understand that we are really their relatives or their neighbors or their colleagues or coworkers, it's kind of hard for them to want to discriminate against us. But as long as we're closeted, we become these rare, exotic sexual creatures that people think about and create a mythology about, but don't really know. I also think it's important for non-gay and lesbian people who support us to come out as our friends and our allies. They'll be listened to, and they won't be harassed or shunned by their friends. They might maybe pitied, but they're not going to be hurt. And I think that, again, it's hard for the community at large to oppress a people if they know that those people are really among them, that they're sitting next to them on the bus, they're working with them, they're in their family. So Coming Out Day for me, really, it's the focal point of the year for the gay and lesbian political agenda, because it is the first step, coming out.
Donna, how do you see the issues of gays and lesbians coming out connected with other political issues that face the larger community?
Clearly, the OCA initiative is targeted toward the gay and lesbian community. But I think it's very dangerous when a group decides to legislate normalcy, when a group decides to legislate what is moral and what isn't. If they're successful muzzling the gay and lesbian community, I wonder who will be next. Will it be people of color? Will it be the poor? Will it be welfare mothers? Who will it be? I think people have to understand that this is just the beginning of their agenda. When one of their people spoke at the city ordinance hearing, his first words were, "I am discriminated against because I'm a straight white man." And then he pretty much laid out the OCA agenda, which is against affirmative action, which is against public support of daycare centers, which is against choice, which is against women's rights. So I think we should take a long, hard look at the OCA agenda and understand that the gay and lesbian community is the easy target. And if we fall, the rest of you are going to fall.
The open mic part of the program has begun. I'm going to see if any of the participants would like to share their views on the radio. Talking with Jeffrey Howard, who just came out to about 600 people. Why did you do it, Jeffrey?
I think it's the most important thing that each individual gay man, lesbian, bisexual can do in this fight against the OCA. Consistently, we have found that The thing that changes people's minds, the thing that shatters the stereotypes about gay men, lesbians, bisexuals, is people knowing us personally. For example, I'll just tell you a little story real quick. My father kicked me out of the house when I told him that I was gay. I came out in high school, he let me finish high school, and then I was gone. But last year, 4 years after I came out to him, he called me up on the phone and said, "So Jeffrey, are you seeing someone?" And I said, "Yes, I am. His name's Brian." And my dad said, "Well, your stepmother and I would like to invite you out to dinner." And we went out to dinner, and it was very nervous. But afterwards, my dad said that he really liked Brian and has been really supportive of me ever since. That's why I came out, because I changed my dad's mind. I shattered the stereotypes that he had about gay men, and I've done it for a lot of other people. My housemate, people I work with, people that I used to go to church with, I hope have changed their perception of what gay men or lesbians or bisexuals are just because they know me personally. And that's why I came out here today, and that's why everybody else came out today, because it's the one thing that we can do as individuals to save our butts against the OCA.
I'm talking with Maxine Israel, who just came out at the open mic at the Coming Out Celebration. Can you tell me, Maxine, why you came down and why it was important to you to come out tonight?
I came out tonight because I think it's really important to be a role model for people who are doing that maybe for the first time or maybe actually haven't done it yet themselves. I am a very out lesbian, and I find that being out gives me great joy and a sense of celebration in my life, and I want to be able to share that. I also am aware of the fact that being out puts a damper on the OCA, that as long as we're closeted, then people have an opportunity to continue to oppress us. They don't know we're there. And a lot of people that just don't know we're there think, well, it's okay. The OCA does what they do. It's not okay, and we need to stand up and say so. That's one of the reasons that I came out tonight, too. I'm also very active, newly active with the OPEU. I'm a relatively new employee of the state and relatively newly a resident in the state. Just came here from Arizona a year ago, and I'm involved with Gay and Lesbian Caucus with the Civil and Human Rights Committee of the OPEU. And I wanted to make a point of bringing to the attention of the crowd that the AFL-CIO just had a statewide conference about 2 weeks ago here where they passed two anti-OCA resolutions. And I understand it was resounding. I wish I personally had been there. I wasn't myself, but it was a resounding passage, and we're very excited that the AFL-CIO did that for us, and this is the first time that they have taken that kind of a strong stand, and we're very excited that they chose now to do it.
Do you see that the unions in general have become more, or in this area anyway, have become more supportive of gay and lesbian rights? Is that something that we can look forward to in the future?
If I have anything to say about it, we do. I don't really know for sure exactly how it's been in the past. I hear that it was kind of difficult before. It still is not the easiest thing in the world. But just to give you an example, I have these stickers that came out of the AFL-CIO conference that say, "I am a unionist. I'm a trade unionist for gay rights. And I work in a multi-service unit in North Portland with a very conservative group of employees, and there's quite a number of people there in the various state agencies in the multi-service unit. And today I had somewhere in the vicinity of 35 to 40 people wearing stickers that said that they were a trade unionist for gay rights, and it was not an easy thing to do, but it was worth it, because these people at first had lots of questions and wanted to know why they should wear that. And after a little bit of talking and a little bit of educating, they were willing to do that, and it was really exciting to see, and it was a tremendous pleasure for me to be supported in that way by my coworkers.
Okay, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us. The political attack on gay and lesbian rights gives clear meaning to the slogan of the 60s and 70s that the personal is political. Gays, lesbians, and bisexuals face the prospect of their private lives becoming legislated into unconstitutionality. The loss of civil rights by this group should itself be a concern of the progressive community. But as Donna Redwing and others have pointed out, it also raises the further chilling question, who's next? For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Andy Simon.
The Old Mole Variety Hour still airs on KBOO every Monday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. You are listening to Treasures from the KBOO Vault. Our second piece we will hear on tonight's program is a panel recorded in 1998 at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force's Creating Change Conference. It was the 10th annual conference, and this year the conference celebrated their 25th anniversary. The primary goal of the Creating Change Conference is to build political power from the ground up and to secure the overarching goal of full equality, social justice, and dignity for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people in the United States. The conference is an opportunity for queer activists, nationally and internationally, to gather, strategize, network, develop leadership skills, get educated, and get activated in the struggle for liberation. This panel of activists will be discussing the issue of globalization, how it fits into the queer agenda, and how, too often, it does not fit into the queer agenda. The panelists will challenge us to expand our ideas of identity politics and of liberation. For a bit of context, let's remember that Matthew Shepard had been murdered 3 months before the conference, and that a little less than 2 years after that conference, globalization activists would shut down the World Trade Organization talks in Seattle. We'll start by hearing the moderator of the panel.
What we are going to talk about is how queer organizing fits into the different organizing strategies around globalization and how globalization in this moment impinges on, provides context for, and sometimes enables different types of queer situations and what to make of that contradiction. We can take some time to distinguish between the period of internationalization that is most often talked about as the development era and internationalization in which the nation state was a coherent unit, and globalization, which is a different period and has a different type of economic conjuncture. We could also talk a little bit about the difference between different types of capital.
That was a panel discussion on globalization recorded at the 10th annual Creating Change Conference in 1998. The 26th Creating Change Conference will be held in Houston, January 29th through February 2nd, 2014.
But the second thing is that
if you missed any part of this program, you can listen to our current archives located on the website kboo.fm.
So the first thing that I wanted to actually do, there was another panel on globalization, I think yesterday morning, that I think a few of you were at. One of the things that started off with was kind of a word association of what did people in the room think globalization was. Some of the things that came up were things like internationalism, a world without borders. And I think that there are some images that we often think hear, at least in the media, when people talk about globalization. We talk about increased access to other cultures. We talk about increased market for goods, increased access to goods, different kinds of goods. So also these cultural signifiers like Nike sneakers that we see supposedly all over the world, as well as McDonald's, which many of our peoples work at all over the world. But what often doesn't get talked about, at least within queer mainstream circles, is what the economic basis is for this globalization and what the, aside from the cultural impact, what it really, how it impacts people's lives on economic basis. And I think part of that is also that we don't often talk about and break down what it means that there's been an increase of rule by transnational corporations, that the nation state is no longer necessarily the primary body that actually rules the planet, but it's actually increasingly transnational corporations that have basic headquarters and are ruled by folks who are in the global north, whether we're talking about Japan or the US or European countries. And at the same time, we don't talk about the fact that that has led to a decreasing relevance of accountability, and that these transnational corporations, because we don't know who the individuals are necessarily, because they're not people who are elected by us, that they're not accountable to us as peoples. And so I think that's something that we need to start off with, to talk about accountability if we are talking as queer progressives in this movement. Next, I also wanted to contextualize what I was going to talk about in terms of the current context and current trends of globalization, and really, really brief some of at least what I see as the adverse impacts of globalization right now. Again, a few of the things that people talk about when they talk about globalization for folks who walked in are things like the revolution of telecommunication, the internet, it now equalizes everybody. I would actually argue that it has actually increased inequality both within countries of the global south as well as in the global north, as well as between the south that is in the north. And I would argue that there is a global south within the north, including the United States, and that's primarily played out in communities of color. A few things, just in case folks don't know. Shandun referred to things like the era of development and what that's meant. Oftentimes, many of us have heard of institutions like the IMF, the World Bank. What we don't necessarily do is make the connections between how the adverse policies and structural adjustment programs and policies of institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, have done to countries in the global south and what the impact is to those of us in the north. And I'm situating all of us right now in the north, in the United States. I don't know where other folks in this room are coming from. I think all of us are coming here via other places, but currently we're sited here, and I think it's important to acknowledge some of the privileges that gives us, and especially because all of us are English speaking. One of the things that has happened since the 80s is that some of the debt crisis, or what has been labeled the debt crisis of countries of the global south, has led to the development of structural adjustment programs and policies, which has meant that there's been economic restructuring forced upon countries of the global south so that the priorities within those countries are no longer the development of indigenous infrastructure like mass transportation or education or basic health and human social services, but rather the primary purpose of what oftentimes gets talked about as the economy is to develop export for countries in the global north. And so another aspect that I hope that we talk about during Q&A and other parts of this panel is what consumption means and how those of us who live in the north, that when we consume goods and then when we talk about goods like the rainbow flag as signifiers of queer identity, we're talking about export, we're talking about not only cultural imperialism, but we're also talking about our reliance of identity and politics and liberation on these specific material goods that don't necessarily have so much to do with our actual liberation as peoples. Well, maybe the rainbow flag does. I don't know. So at the same time, I would say that right now in the United States, what we're also seeing is something that isn't called structural adjustment programs or policies, but in many ways is, that we're seeing economic restructuring going on in the United States right now and in many of the quote-unquote Western democracies that had certain policies in place for the past 10, 20 years that protected workers' rights. We're seeing an erosion of workers' rights. What we're actually seeing is that instead of investing in actual infrastructure that helps the peoples of the countries, we're seeing that folks are now instead investing resources into how we pay off something that's called the national debt, and that all of our energies around economy go into paying off the national debt. And for many of us, this is a very abstract concept, right? Most of us have debt for a lot of other different reasons, whether it's student loans or because we don't pay rent. So part of what that has meant is that we siphon off resources that could go into things like funding for youth programs or like basic health and human social services. We've talked about HIV and AIDS at this conference. We could be putting some money into women's health research specifically, into prevention methods for a lot of different kinds of diseases and treatments. And instead what we do is talk about this abstract of debt, and that what ends up happening is that gets played out most often on the backs of communities of color, but also on working class women, whether or not they're based in communities of color. And I just wanted to throw out that I hope that part of this discussion today is not about only internationalism, about helping those people over there, but also recognizing that many of us are here and located here and can't go anywhere else, and that we need to structure that into our conversation around globalization. A few last things. One is that I feel like it's extremely important, and most of us are here because we believe that queer liberation is crucial to our survival, but many of us define queer liberation very differently. Some of us define it as sexual liberation, as freedom to be able to express ourselves sexually, as well as in terms of eroticism. At the same time, I think that those of us who identify as progressive queers need to really ensure a broadening of the queer agenda. I feel like I'm doing this mantra of broaden the queer agenda, and some of us who've been in some of the same panels this past week are probably sick of me saying this, but what I really want to emphasize is that those of us who come from countries like the United States oftentimes hear about this liberty and justice as something that's political and civil rights oriented, meaning the right to be queer or the right to be out. What we don't often talk about are economic and social rights, like the freedom from poverty and the freedom for full employment for all of our peoples. For many of us, those things cannot be separated. For some of us within communities, we can't be queer and only think about being queer and out if we're not even feeding ourselves, if we're being kicked out of our homes, if we're being evicted. And so I hope that we can start personalizing some of that and bringing it down to actually concrete examples. A few last comments. I just wanted to say a few things about why we wanted to do this panel. And I think that for some folks, it's a little odd to have a panel on globalization or something called globalization at a queer conference. Oftentimes when I talk to folks about globalization, what I hear back, at least from queers, is, oh, so what kind of queer liberation stuff is happening in country X? And is it really true that they also use the rainbow flag? And is it really true that they take on the word gay and lesbian? I would like to suggest for us that those are not the critical questions, that what people call themselves are not necessarily the critical questions to our liberation, that if we're truly involved in liberation work, what we want to talk about are things like, what are the things that are stopping people from achieving freedom or from achieving basic necessity, whether we're here in the North or the South. Last few things is that as individuals who are cited in the United States and in a northern country, I think it's important to recognize our privilege within that and to use it to change the United States. I have a friend of mine who is a minister who often says that what's happened in our country, which is El Salvador, it's wonderful that people do quote-unquote solidarity work, but what people in the United States really need to do is governance and learn how to govern themselves. And I think that as folks who are in the United States, one of the things we do need to understand and learn and hold people accountable around is how to govern ourselves, how to govern our country, how to govern the people within it, so that we're not subsidizing transnational corporations so that they can go and exploit our people here and abroad, but instead that we're actually holding them accountable to making actually globalization not mean the things that we usually think about it as meaning, but making globalization mean something like taking a full inventory of all the resources of the world and creating a much more equitable redistribution. I know we're not supposed to say redistribution and these lefty kind of things at this conference, but we're going to say it. All I want to say is that I hope that we can change the definition to equitable redistribution of resources, and that that's what globalization should actually mean, and not just cultural signifiers.
Hi. My name is Mirka Negroni, and I work with an organization called the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. And the piece that I would like to talk a little about is something that both troubles and consumes a lot of my working and personal life, and that is the ethics of how we participate as people, in my case, living in the global north, having the immigration advantage of being a Puerto Rican, which as a colony of the U.S. means I carry a U.S. passport. How, within that context of who I am, Harvard grad, so forth and so on, I can participate in the struggles that are happening in other places, in my case, Latin America, and I love the concept of a Latin America division at Eagle Herc. There is a Latin America person, which is yours truly. But I wanted to talk a little bit about sort of the ethics that go behind how we organize our work and that really enable me to be able to work there. And it has to do with a real belief that local communities that are working on liberation struggles in those communities are the ones that are best able to tell us what we can do in terms of support, when we should stay the hell out, because an intervention on our part as U.S. citizens is nothing but harmful and quite dangerous to local organizing efforts, and in what instances it is indeed, as often gets said, a local issue and quite truly none of our business. While Eagle Herc has made many mistakes and will continue to make mistakes because the org as people is not perfect, that centering our organizing work in the organizing work that is happening already enables us to do a work that I can live with as a, oh my God, dare I say it, lefty, socialist, Puerto Rican. The way in which that works varies, and the ability for even that construct to work ethically depends on our ability to build alliances and to meet people and to find out about the organizing that's going on in a particular region. And so that means that in certain places, it's going to be affected by who we can and will meet, and therefore perhaps not be always the best choice. And the attempt is always to reach as many organizers as we can in a country. And I'm lucky enough in Latin America that many of the countries have quite elaborate, in many ways, much more progressive queer movements than we have in this country. And so that I'm able to access from their own local organizing, their own national agendas, places where we can intervene that are useful, that are helpful, that are not damaging. I think I also want to talk a little bit about the way in which we use this human rights framework and the ways in which that for me is very exciting and very different from other gay and lesbian work that I've done in the U.S. I come at this very interestingly, even though a lot of people know me and I've been at these NGLTF conferences for a real long time. Before coming to Eagle Herc, I had never done gay and lesbian or queer work professionally. I had always worked for Latino orgs. I worked for Aspira, which is a Latino youth leadership org. I had been executive director at an immigrant rights group. And so it was with a little bit of caution that I entered the work at Eagle Herc and was fascinated by the use of human rights framework. And I think in a Latin American context for me, it made a ton of sense. Human rights is something that has been that has been happening in Latin America for many, many years. And that precedes us. And it's a way that the activists there feel quite comfortable talking about getting access to their rights, which is very different from a civil rights framework and the way that we work in this country. And so I think that, combined with our real commitment to letting local groups determine locally driven actions for us to participate. And sometimes that means we don't participate. And it's interesting to me the response that I get from other activists, because now with the internet and TV and what have you, people find out and they're like, I can't believe you're not doing something about X situation in Y country. I'm like, well, we've talked to the activists in Y country, and they've told us that we really ought to stay the hell out of there. That for various reasons, an intervention from our organization would really be less than useful. And it's interesting to hear people, but it's horrible and you need to participate. And I think the local activists are dealing with that situation. And and it's sometimes one of these things where I just go on my little Quaker thing and say, let's just agree to disagree. I wanted to touch on a couple different examples of situations where I think it's been helpful and situations where perhaps it wasn't as helpful. There was an incident with some United States citizens flying on Mexicana, two lesbians, getting kicked out of the of a Mexicana plane for physical displays of affection. After a lot of conversation back and forth with different activists in Mexico, we decided to take it on. It's sort of an unusual case because it's U.S. citizens in another country, and I think one that we approached with a certain degree of, we're not really sure we should be doing this, and the activists saying, no, do it. You really need to do it. If these women are willing to come forward, we want to be supportive, and we want to be doing actions in Mexico. And one which I personally got a lot of flack for, because I think people didn't understand that our process and sort of these things had been run by people in the country and that there had been a support for us acting, calling an action on that particular occasion. Two other things that I think are troubling to me as I do this work that are happening a lot and have a lot to do with the way in which we are, this whole concept of globalization and the way that governments in the North want to participate more and more in gay and lesbian struggles in the South. And it's this whole notion of international funding becoming available for the first time for queer orgs. And the ways in which it can be very problematic. There's some wonderful things that come out of the possibility of having that money. Unfortunately, in some cases, the money can be dumped into a particular group in a country, huge amounts of money, producing really horrible effects on the local organizing efforts in that country because they totally destabilize the other folks who are doing work in that country by putting all the money into one activist that this one funding agency happened to have access to. Not to mention the problems that come up around race, class, and gender as to who has access to influencing these funders and contacting them in the first place. And I think for me that's something that has been very troubling in the recent past. And I think that I must say that a lot of the international funding agencies have really taken it on to do a couple things. One is to learn a ton more about a country before they go in, which I think is useful, to try and give smaller pots of money to more different kinds of organizations, and to understand that queer organizing in other countries happens in really different contexts, in context of women's organizing, in context of HIV/AIDS organizing, in the context of health organizing. And so I think that's been, it's an ongoing struggle, and I think one that I hope that they'll be up to task to. The other development that has been really disconcerting lately is the growth of sex tourism. There's a couple of different problems that I have with sex tourism. One is that oftentimes countries that are exhibiting an increase in gay tourism, and I say gay quite purposely, because I don't think that any of these sex tourism sites are targeting lesbians as a really sort of large group that's going to come visit. Because, we have all this disposable income. off of that 50 cents out of the dollar that we make. It is very much targeted to gay men. One of the problems that occurs, besides the many ethical problems that one may have with the whole concept of sexist tourism, is that that gets used as an excuse by northern governments to all of a sudden declare that that country no longer has a problem with homophobia, and that people from that country should no longer be allowed to immigrate based on the basis of sexual persecution, because after all, look, there's this gay tourism. You know, the really troubling part of that is there are these, not always gay white men, but there are these gay men who get to travel to these countries, who have sex with folks there, and who are the sex workers, under various conditions of power and disempower for sex workers. And the only one who's getting anything out of the deal, thank you very much, is the people that are traveling there. The situation for gay men and trans workers in that country hasn't changed. The only thing that's changed is that the government has wised up to the fact that they can get money out of this thing, and then can squeeze money out of this thing, and so that's what's happening. I will posit that the growth in sex tourism does not necessarily, and quite often does not lead at all, to a growth in sexual liberation in that country for people that are living there. The other problem related to the growth in sex tourism is this growth in folks going to countries to write about our people. And then there's a whole industry that has developed now, both in travel guides and also in academic research, around going to countries to study the local queer population and then come back and tell us the truth on the one queer population in the country. I have problems with this on a whole bunch of different levels. I'm not saying that academic research in other countries is not something that should happen. I just think that the concept that someone can go somewhere, spend some time there, and then come back and write a book about the entire movement seems preposterous. In the same way that we would all think that it was preposterous that someone could come here and write a book and be inclusive of the entire queer movement in this country. Now that I've done my little soapboxes, I wanted to sort of move a little bit into something that David is going to talk about in terms of how we do, both in terms of what happens with new immigrant communities here, but also in my community, that is of Puerto Ricans, whose largest suburb is actually New York. There's a ton of organizing that is currently happening in Puerto Rico. But there was a point at which there was an attempt by Puerto Ricans that had gone to New York and wanted to return to bring sort of an ACT-UP model to Puerto Rico. And it was an effort that really failed miserably. And it failed miserably on a whole bunch of different levels. I think on one level, because as Puerto Ricans, we're a very migratory people, we can come and go. Our border is very permeable. We come and go a lot. We often forget that once we move here, we're living in this reality, which is a very different reality from that which is lived in Puerto Rico. Despite the fact that it's a colony of the U.S., the realities that are there are very different. I think that now we have, or at least it's been my experience, and people who are living in the Puerto Rican community in New York can stand up and correct me, that there's an attempt to work much more respectfully with the organizing that's going there. There's been a recognition that there's been an indigenous movement in Puerto Rico since 1970s, that we don't all come out when we come here, that people come out in Puerto Rico and stay there, and that it actually is possible to be queer and Puerto Rican in Puerto Rico. And the point in all of that is that I think as folks that are living in la diaspora, because I can never pronounce that word in English, we do need to look both to situate ourselves, as we keep saying, within our privilege, but also within our difference. And that really, we can never really, really go home. That when we go home, we bring this home with us. And that many of us straddle 2 and 3 and 4 homes, currently straddling at least 3, Puerto Rico, Mexico, and the U.S. And I think finally, I just wanted to talk a little bit. The other personal ethics of doing international work is that I've seen this whole cropping of international divas. I remember when I first started doing this work that one of the things that I promised myself is that I would not be an international diva. That it felt ridiculous to go to other countries to learn about the organizing going there if the only organizing that I was doing was getting paid to look at their organizing. So I wanted to talk a little bit about 2 projects that I'm working on that both have to do with new immigrant communities in the Bay Area. One is I'm working on a Latina lesbian domestic violence project that targets Spanish-speaking Latinas in an attempt to both provide a service to a community that is often disserviced at a time when we don't want to service anybody who doesn't speak English. Also, my personal need to be doing things in my own language. And I'm also working with a group, just recently started working with a group in San Jose called Pro Latinas. That's the first time that I have had the opportunity living in the U.S., other than when I lived in D.C., of having a Spanish language Latina lesbian org that I can call home. So those are two projects that I work on, just keep myself a little centered, to not lose track of what it is that's important, and to not forget that while I may be blessed and honored with the opportunity of working with other activists in other countries, at least for the time being, Oakland is home. Thank you.
You are listening to Treasures from the KABU Vault. We are currently in the middle of a panel discussion on globalization recorded at a conference in 1998. This is KBOO Portland.
My name is Javed Sayed, and I just wanted to start what I wanted to talk about, which was the implications of globalization on local queer organizing, by once more putting together the pieces that make sense to me around what Jihyun was saying about how globalization has led to the erosion of nation states, and this move towards international privatization has also done lots of things locally. And one of the things around creating a depression of international wages and creating economic conditions that lead to immigration patterns has affected local communities of immigrants emerging. And one of the other moves towards privatization in the national spectra is this move to dismantle the social service networks that we have. And so that has put our communities in particular situations. What all of those things lead to is an immigrant community of color over here that is, in many cases, undocumented, and in almost all cases, of low income. And so in those realities, situated outside of the political spectra here, and also not really available to electoral politics. And so in that context, what does it mean for us to be doing queer organizing in local immigrant queer communities of color? What I've come to understand through my work in New York City has been that you cannot really do it specifically through queer stuff all the time, and that some of the things that we need to organize around are really social service issues that communities will come up with. And so for the South Asian Lesbian Gay Association, for example, what that has meant is that we couldn't always do queer activism, but when we did work around asylum, lots of more working class queer South Asians came forward to talk about their asylum histories or the experiences of immigration here and what asylum meant for them. And also, again, while talking about asylum, we have to just not locate it in reaction to the human rights abuses of the countries of origin, but also talk about how asylum is a particular political route that people choose to access because of the lack of access to various resources in the U.S. So asylum, therefore, becomes an important queer organizing issue for us as immigrants of color, whereas for most mainstream queer organizations, asylum does not seem like a queer issue. The second thing around HIV/AIDS stuff that I want to talk about, because my work in New York City is around HIV/AIDS, that while talking around in communities of color about HIV/AIDS, it is still not seen as an issue. But what is seen as an issue, again, is also not sexual identity, but realities like economic realities, like what does it mean to be a domestic worker, and what does that have to do with the global trafficking of women? What does that have to do with economic realities that are going to put women in vulnerable situations in relation to domestic violence? And then how can we organize around domestic violence and really talk about HIV in all those contexts to make it seem really relevant to those communities? So in summary, what I want to say was globalization has led to particular social, political, economic realities in very specific locations that require us to think of social services as a major arena for organizing for queer communities of color. Because those populations are still outside of the electoral realm, what that means for us who are more entrenched in the political structure here, not me personally because I don't have a green card or anything of that sort, But what that really means for communities of color or for progressive allies, white or non-white, who are here and have a different sense of history in the electoral politics or in the power structure of the U.S., is that they really need to start taking up these issues. Because if they don't, then these service provisions will not really be even available. Because service provision quite often is only possible when arenas for advocacy and then those advocacy efforts leading to resources become viable. And those sorts of situations are only really available when there's someone in the political structure that is going to be a conduit through which you can make those social services available.
In all three talks, what our plan was that while the talks seem contradictory in the sense that they seem to contradict each other, that was the point of the panel, that we all actually hold these feelings about working in these different communities simultaneously, and that depending upon what work you're doing and what community you're located in, your strategy is going to be different. I think that that's one of the things that we want to emphasize the most about our sense on organizing under globalization. Whether you feel this way or that way about globalization, it's unavoidable. And the thing is to do what Ju Hyun said, which is to really turn it around, to turn globalization around from like capital maximization to resources redistribution maximization. Secondly, in doing that turning around, we have to really take the concept of strategy very seriously. I think that one thing that Mirka was saying that connects well with this is to understand that as strategic as we are in the North, people in the South are similarly strategic, and we forget that, particularly when we talk about we access gay identities, gay movements, gay literature, if we're looking in the literary realm, gay TV as socially real expressions of what's going on there. And we don't take a minute to think about all the strategies of composition that went into this stuff, all the different negotiations that were made in order to make this representation or to make this movement or to make this organization. It comes out really well when you think about the way in which Mexican activists were strategically using U.S. citizenship to make an issue in Mexico. That strategy, that's not false consciousness, or that's not looking at the North. That strategy driven work. And if we don't think about how complex strategy on that side is and always think of strategy on our side, then we'll always be looking at those things as like representations with open arms to be taken by us, instead of seeing that they're actually written and done, knowing that we're going to come and interfere and they have the strategy for it. I think Javed made really intelligible for us the double embrace that needs to be happening when we're organizing in globalization in the North, which is that on the one hand, we have to embrace social services. We have to embrace all those things that are racist about this country, like the erosion of welfare, like the demarcation of certain people who work as illegitimate and undocumented and other people who work as legitimate and documented, the lack of social services and health services given to people with HIV, et cetera. We have to embrace that struggle. And at the same time, we have to, in our own communities, turn to culture and turn into like indigenous social infrastructure for ways of not embracing citizenship and American national identity as our end. So while on the one hand we're struggling against racism and the welfare state, on the other hand we're taking the time to build cultural organizations and cultural practices and social organizations that provide us an alternative to American identity and to American nationality, and that way our locality is connected strategically to localities in the South that are also against national platforms, etc. So I'll leave off there on some strategy comments and then we can go into discussions and go from there.
The first question that came up, which I thought was pretty telling, was how does globalization, how does immigration rights, how does welfare, how does capitalism all fit into what too often is a very narrow definition of queer rights?
You know, I think it's a really complicated and long conversation. So part of what I'm going to say is not going to do justice to it, but it's a few examples that pop to my mind. And I think it really has to do with what we consider central issues of queer liberation movements. And whether we will willingly allow our institutions, whether they are community centers, whether they are schools or what have you, to narrowly define our existence and to say that the only thing we need to care about this year is hate crimes bill, or the only thing we need to care about this year is domestic partnership. I think that's part of the problem, that we're not holding our own institutions accountable in some ways. And not only those of us who identify strongly with the issue, but those of us who understand that those issues are critical to many people within our queer community. One example I would give in New York City and we're not naming organizations. There's a campaign around workfare. For those of us who have heard of workfare, because it's sprouting out in different areas of the country, it's part of the response and part of the strategy around destruction of the welfare system, right? We are going to not give people welfare anymore because they need to be working. They need to be working in all these different settings. And as a result, we're going to decrease workers' wages across the board because we'll replace it with unsubsidized or less subsidized work by people who are supposed to be, quote unquote, earning paychecks. I see that as a fundamental queer issue, and there's a few reasons why. I think that there are sites of queer struggle within workfare environments. One is the fact that there are no worker protections, so if your boss doesn't like you because you're queer, you're gone. You don't have a way to get a welfare check after that. You don't have any subsidy. And then there are other folks who we do increase other kind of social and economic problems within our communities. I see that as a fundamental queer issue also because so many of our communities are cited in communities that are under attack because of the destruction of the welfare system right now. The person who's organizing one of the responses on this work experience program, which is Workfare in New York City, is a white dyke who is situated in something that's not a queer organization. It's called the Urban Justice Center, and she's been leading this. She's reached out to a number of queer organizations around New York City. There's probably only three who've signed on to this pledge of resistance against workfare. And the pledge of resistance essentially says that we as nonprofit organizations will not take on workfare clients. We might think that our situations might be, quote unquote, more benevolent than other situations the workfare clients are in. However, we won't take them on because we understand that the system is unjust. And by allowing additional space for workfare folks to be herded into, that we expand and justify the welfare destruction, also the workfare system. Most of the queer organizations in New York City wouldn't sign on to it. It's not only that they didn't, they wouldn't. And they didn't see this a queer issue, and they don't see this important. And I think to be able to talk about the impact of globalization on our communities, we need to be able to hold our institutions accountable to signing on to more than queer, quote unquote, queer stuff, and to understand that broader agenda.
I'm just going to make a quick plug and an answer. There's a new book out on globalization, and it's called The Politics of Culture in the Shadow of Capital. And it's edited by Lisa Lowe and David Lloyd. The reason I'm making the plug is that there's an interview in there by Angela Davis. Angela Davis remains for us a very instructive activist because here's a person who was very, very articulate and fought in the civil rights movement and fought during Black Power movement and is now working, as she has been since the period of her incarceration, with women of color in prisons. Her most recent work has been focused on women of color labor in prison and the use of the privatization of the prison industry and the use of that privatization by the prison industry, private prisons, to advertise cheap labor for global manufacturing firms, from car seats to seats at schools to clothing, etc. What Angela Davis does is in this interview, but in her work, has really been to show that even if you're founded upon a particular situation, like you're founded on queer liberation, you can use that foundation in all these different ways, you know, and you have to go to the sites that are most active. If you're interested in globalization, you have access to it right here. And if your organization is not interested in that, then it has to be honest about that, because that's when accountability comes in. It's when your organization says, you know what, we don't care about poor people. We don't care about people of color off of welfare. That people of color off of welfare and on welfare, that progressive white gays and lesbians will say, you know what, we don't want to give your center our money then. But until they say that, until they say that, instead of saying, oh, you know, it's because we're not really founded on that situation, we just don't know how to get there, that's not honest. And when you're not honest, that's the way you're actually tricking the people who are supporting you. And I think Angela Davis is a great example of someone who is solidly founded on Black liberation, U.S.-based. And where she's gone right now shows you that that's the reality.
Just one last thing that Shanda reminded me of. I think it's also important for us to remember the word ethnocentrism. Too oftentimes our institutions within queer struggles are extremely ethnocentric, but not only are they ethnocentric, they are not transparent in terms of where the accountability structures lie and who actually makes decisions for whom. We have this rhetoric that's been inherited from women's movements and other movements of inclusion within queer liberation movements, I think, oftentimes. And part of that also has not made transparent where power lies in most institutions that are queer identified in this country. And most of them do lie in the hands of either white gay men that are middle class or white gay men and white lesbians. Some of us need to make that transparent. I'm not doing a plug to say that every center should be people of color led. I don't think that's the answer either. But I think that we do need to make transparent where accountability lies, who holds the power, and we need to take that power back for ourselves.
And, you know, in terms of how to integrate this work, it is about really looking at, like you said, the sites that are most active, the sites where are most of the attacks coming at people of color from. Looking at those places and then doing work around those issues will bring these communities to your site. And then they will provide you with really instructive information on how they want to see their social liberation organized and how they want to organize it themselves. So I think in some ways, the fact that we don't do this work is really part of the whole cycle of educating ourselves. So Judith's question was about creating change is really mostly represent white TGs, and that as I work in API transgender immigrant communities, how does transgender get constructed differently? One of the things that's really clear to me in doing this work in TG communities of API descent and immigrant communities is that it's not just, the rhetoric is not necessarily a very naturalized rhetoric, but the rhetoric is quite clearly about particular historical, economic, and gender situations that people have come to identify and inhabit this TG identity in. So, for example, the TG, you know, API sex worker in New York is really, she sees the links in some ways to the fact that her country was colonized and how API men are emasculated and how that gives her access to certain kinds of gender identities, how immigration impacts in a certain economic way on her, how being an undocumented immigrant makes only certain kinds of work sites available to her, and then how she becomes this APITG sex worker. And so in that context, to organize around that is not necessarily to organize around TG identities, but to organize around violence on the street against sex workers in general, and talk about it in the context of global trafficking of labor, of women, and queers for various reasons. And it's also linked to the globalization of the sex industry and how API men and API TGs get to be exoticized or eroticized. So I think that is really clear to me in doing the work there, is that those connections are made. Folks want that to be addressed in their organizing.
I would just like to say, while we're calling our community's task, that one of the things that troubles me about the organizing that I do oftentimes in the Latino-Latina community is the fact that TGs often in conferences get, even in those spaces where it's folks of color, get relegated to situations where it's performance and where it's art and where it's creativity and don't participate in this complicated political discussions of what's going on, unless, of course, class intervenes, in which case they do participate. And so I think there's this whole disconnect between some of the organizing that we're doing in our Latino community and some of the really interesting, really incredible work that TG sex workers are doing around HIV and AIDS. And it's something that we keep calling on ourselves, and I hope we'll continue to do.
That was a panel discussion on globalization recorded at the 10th Annual Creating Change Conference in 1998. The 26th Creating Change Conference will be held in Houston, January 29th through February 2nd, 2014. If you missed any part of this program, you can listen to our current archives located on the website kboo.fm. Thanks for listening. Yeah.
Tune in to Shocks of Sheba this Thursday, June 6th at noon as we share an exclusive interview with reggae legend Max Romeo. Again, that's this Thursday, June 6th, Shocks of Sheba with Max Romeo, a KABU exclusive.
Good evening. The time is 7 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for Hard Knock Radio.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
What's up, fam? You're tuned to Hard Knock Radio here on the Pacifica Network. On today's program, we look at the Farm Bill with reporter Brenton Mock of Color Lines. And later we speak with songbird Jennifer Johns and actor Czar about the play, the musical Fela. I'm Anita Johnson. All this and more ahead. This week in Washington, D.C., politicians are preparing to vote on a $955 billion farm bill.